We are trying to study this quarter some material that we have called Bible Background for Richer Understanding of Scripture. And we have looked at various things this quarter, and what I want to finish with or get into today is to look at some of the elements of the government that existed in Palestine. It was a little different than what we might normally anticipate in a national government, because it not only had a national government, but it had a local government, and sometimes those were a little bit different. For instance, when Jesus was born, get your Bibles, look in Matthew chapter 2 and Luke chapter 2. Beginning the first couple verses of Matthew 2, the first couple verses of Luke chapter 2. When Jesus was born, just before he was born, the Bible says in Luke chapter 2 that a decree went out that all man should pay his taxes, all man should be registered in the city of his birth. In Luke chapter 2 and verse 1, who did that decree go forth from? It went forth from Caesar. Caesar sent out a decree to the entire nation that they should go to their home and be registered. Which Caesar was this? Julius Caesar? Caesar Augustus. When you read the name or the word Caesar, you know, it's almost like you're reading the Egyptian name Pharaoh. Sometimes when we read the story about Moses and Pharaoh, we think Pharaoh was the guy's name. And so when we read about other pharaohs, we think, well, is that the same name? It was a position, although they began to be called Pharaoh because of their position, but it was not necessarily their name. Same thing with Caesar. Caesar represented a position. There were a number of Caesars that ruled over the Roman Empire. But look in Matthew chapter 2. In Matthew chapter 2, you read about a little bit different form of government. In Matthew chapter 2 and verse 1, Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of who? In the days of Herod the king. So when Jesus was born, who was king? Herod. When Jesus was born, who was the highest ruler in the land? Was it the king? No, it was Caesar. It was the Roman Caesar. And so I think it's important for us today to try to get a grasp of how does the Roman system of politics and government relate to some of the other forms of government that we read about in the New Testament. We're going to focus this in, especially in the life of Jesus. We'll look a little beyond that into the book of Acts. But I hope some of this will be helpful for us today. If you were to write down the names of all of the Caesars, and we'll actually, except for Julius Caesar, we'll have most of them on the screen today. It would be helpful for you to know the progression of the Caesars in the Roman Empire. From the standpoint of just knowing names, knowing how they functioned, how they were characterized. For instance, here's Augustus Caesar. Augustus Caesar was the Caesar who was obviously, according to Luke chapter 2 and verse 1, was on the throne when Jesus was born. He's the one who issued that decree for everyone to go back to the city of their birth to be registered. He's the one when in your history classes, when you've learned about the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, it was Augustus Caesar who was responsible for that action being brought into that nation. As you read about him, you begin to see in Acts chapter 27 and verse 1 that there was a guard who was guarding Paul. And the name of this guard was Julius, and it was said of this guard that he was of the regiment, the Augustan regiment. So here's Augustus Caesar. Beginning in 63, and I don't think I've got that up there, but beginning in 63 BC, the Roman Empire became the fourth major world empire that was talked about in the book of Daniel. When Daniel prophesied, who was the major world empire at that time? Nebuchadnezzar was king of what nation? Babylon. So Daniel was a captive in the nation of Babylon, which was the major world empire at that time. But Daniel prophesied that Babylon would not always be the dominant force. What nation was going to come and conquer the Babylonian Empire? The Medes and the Persians. The nation of the Medes, the nation of the Persians would join forces under Darius and Cyrus, and they would come together, and that newly formed union would come and conquer Babylon. So that would be the second major world empire. After a period of time, that nation would also fall. Who was going to conquer the Medo-Persian Empire? The Greeks. Who was the most famous of those Greeks? Alexander the Great. But in 63 B.C., Greece fell to the Roman Empire, becoming that fourth Roman or that fourth world empire that Daniel talked about in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44. And so any time, starting there in 63 B.C., during the period of the Roman Empire, any time in that period, Daniel 2 could be fulfilled. Any time in that era, the kingdom of God could be established based upon the promise of what Daniel prophesied there. And so here's Augustus, who was the one who was on the throne in Luke chapter 2. When he died, Tiberius came to the throne. Look in Luke chapter 3 where he is mentioned by name. He's mentioned in Luke chapter 3 along with several others that we're not going to try to get into today. But now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. Now, 15th year of his reign. Do a little math. Tiberius came to the throne in 14 A.D. In what year are we reading Luke chapter 3? 15th year of his reign. 14, Richard, you got your calculator? 14 plus 15... That'd be one. That's pretty close. So somewhere around the year 29 A.D., we're reading that Tiberius is the Roman Caesar at this time. You'll notice as you read through Scripture that here again the name Caesar, the word Caesar, is again used to apply to him. And so here's the Caesar who is on the throne for Jesus' earthly ministry. Jesus, we know, ministered on this earth for about 3.5 years. So Tiberius was the Caesar during that entire period. When Jesus had this exchange in Matthew chapter 22 about whether they should pay taxes, and when Jesus said, look at the coin, whose image is on the coin? Whose image was always on the currency? In the Roman Empire. Caesar. Which Caesar? The reigning Caesar. Wouldn't that be cool? You're not only Caesar, but your picture's on the money. You know, in our nation, you got to be long gone, right? And have done something fairly decent to end up on our currency. But imagine when you came to the throne, if you got to recall all of that money that had been printed by the government, you got to recall all of that currency and make your own. So when Jesus says, whose image is on that coin, render unto Caesar the thing that are Caesar's, he wasn't talking about Julius, he wasn't talking about Augustus, he is talking about Tiberius. When you read about Pilate having Jesus on trial, and the enemies of Jesus said to Pilate, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. They're talking about Tiberius. Tiberius was the one who had appointed Pilate for his position. We'll talk about Pilate in a minute. Tiberius, Roman emperor, was the one who had appointed Pilate to be the governor there in Judea. So when Jesus' enemies say, if you let him go, you're no friend of Caesar, why did that strike fear in Pilate's heart? What was going to happen? He's going to lose his job. And he did. Eventually, about 4 or 5 years later, he did. He had so many debacles during his administration that he finally did lose his job. So we've got Augustus, we've got Tiberius. Then you go a little bit later and you read about Caligula in history, although we don't read about him in the New Testament. But what specifically stands out about Caligula is that he began, he began to really emphasize emperor worship among the Caesars. Now, think about this. You're not only the emperor. Your image is not only on the money. It's not, that's all about you. Now this man who is the emperor begins to demand that his subjects in the empire, hopefully that wasn't a kid being thrown against the wall, that, well, it depends on which kid, I guess. That shouldn't have come out, I'm sorry. So, what were we talking about? The Caesars begin to demand that the people worship him. Can you imagine living in a nation? You remember Nebuchadnezzar? Remember Nebuchadnezzar when he built that 90-foot golden image? Who did Nebuchadnezzar say to bow down to? The golden image. Roman emperors were not saying, bow down to this golden image. Roman emperors were saying, bow down to me. You need to worship me. And history tells us that Caligula even wanted to put a statue of himself in the temple in Jerusalem. Didn't get to, but that was in his plans. What sort of reaction do you think that may have had if he had been able to follow through with those plans? A Jewish revolt would have happened. Eventually it did. A couple decades later, the Jews did revolt against what was happening. But then after Caligula, you've got Claudius. And we read about Claudius in the New Testament because his time frame covered a lot of Paul's missionary journeys. When you read about Claudius, we read about him especially in Acts chapter 18, because it is there that we read about him expelling the Jews from the city of Rome. And among those Jews were Aquila and Priscilla, who were thrown out. Why was he getting rid of the Jews? Why was he expelling the Jews from Rome? Did he have a Hitler complex? Why is he expelling the Jews from Rome?
He was having trouble corralling them,
Jerry says, controlling them. Part of the problem is that at this time, there was no understanding or recognition of the difference between Jews and Christians. This time, they were just, in the Roman mind, they were just lumped together. You know, they're just, to them, they were just factions of the same grouping, except they weren't. And at this time, there was a great deal of conflict between the Christians and the Jews. When you read through the book of Acts, you know, you read through the New Testament and Christians were persecuted. You read the first couple chapters of the book of Revelation and you read about the persecutions that were coming upon those churches. Well, when you start reading about those later persecutions, that was Gentile or Roman or outside persecution against the Christians. But the early persecution against Christians was brought upon them by who? The Jews. The Jews were the first. Who was Paul? Was he not a Jew? Was he not the greatest persecutor of the Christians? And so Jews were responsible for much of that early persecution. And so here they are in the city of Rome. You got Jews, you got Christians, you got Jews persecuting Christians, you got all of this conflict. And Claudius finally says, you know, get out. He wasn't looking at just Jews or Christians saying, well, I like one or I don't like the other. He looks at them as one batch and he expels them from the city. And so Aquila and Priscilla are a part of that. And so as we go down this progression of these emperors, we get down to Nero. Nero was not, his name is not mentioned in the New Testament, but he is, not by name. Remember that the word Caesar, the name Caesar, just refers to the emperor. When Paul appealed unto Caesar, when he appealed that he might be brought before Caesar, that was Nero. I think it ought to give us an even deeper appreciation for Paul to know that even when he had an opportunity, seemingly, to be released from captivity, that he appealed and said, no, I will go before Caesar. Who in their right mind, as a Christian of all people, who in their right mind would want to go and stand before Nero? Nero was one of the most vile and vicious men against Christians. Why would you want to go stand before him? Well, Paul wanted to go and stand there, one, for justice's sake. Paul was a Roman citizen. Did that give him certain rights? Yes. Were those rights infringed upon repeatedly upon his arrest and his beating and his imprisonment? Yes. And so for the sake of justice, Paul was just going up the chain. No, guys, you're not going to get off the hook on this one. I appeal unto Caesar. But what was Paul's greater motivation? What did Paul really want the opportunity to do? To spread the gospel. Was he primarily concerned about his own justice? Was he primarily concerned about making sure his rights weren't infringed upon? It's interesting that in Paul's mind, he saw an opportunity to stand before the most powerful man in all of the world. Regardless of the fact that he was the most vicious man in all of the world. The most powerful man in all. Do you suppose when Paul stood before him, you suppose that he took up his entire time with his legal matters? Do you suppose that Paul was his own studied attorney and so he was representing himself and he was just appealing unto Caesar for his own justice? Do you think he spent most of his time trying to appeal for himself or appeal unto God? If you had the opportunity to stand before the most powerful man in all of the world, what would you say to him? Knowing that he held your life right there in the palm of his hand. Knowing that because of certain accusations that had been brought against you and certain actions that had been taken, that just with the snap of his finger, you were dead. And Nero would be responsible. A little later on, history tells us, for both Peter and Paul's martyrdom. So eventually, he was killed by Nero. What would you say standing before the most powerful man in all the world who's got your life right there? Would you even peep? Would you even let out any idea that you believed in God? That you believe in Jesus? That you are a servant of the Most High? That you were standing before him so that you could tell him that Jesus died for him and that Jesus wanted him to be saved? Would you say that to him? That's all Paul wanted to say, is to preach the gospel. When you read the book of Philippians, the first time Paul was in prison, he writes the book of Philippians, and he writes not only in the first chapter, but he also writes at the end of the last chapter about those in Caesar's household. who had heard and been obedient to the gospel. Here he was in prison, and yet he's still finding opportunities to preach the gospel, not only to Nero himself, but even to anyone who would come and listen to him. And it was during Nero's reign, this man who was so cruel unto Christians, it was during his reign that the first Jewish war broke out in 66 AD. Following Nero's death, we've got three Roman Caesars who didn't reign for very long. We don't know a whole lot about them, but that brings us to the last three I want us to talk about this morning. And then we're going to look at how this collaborates with the Jewish government. There was Vespasian. And again, these names may not be overly familiar to you, but Vespasian was one of the great Roman generals of all time. He was the one who came down in about 66 to Jerusalem and Judea to take care of the Jewish rebellion. When the Jews rebelled and revolted, it was the responsibility of Nero to send Vespasian down to deal with them. So Vespasian came down in order to try to calm what was happening and take care of business, as it were. Look in Matthew chapter 22. Go over to the book of Matthew. Because in Matthew chapter 22, although he's not mentioned again by name, Vespasian and his activities are mentioned in a parable of Jesus. In Matthew chapter 22, Jesus spoke a parable. In verse 2, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son. He sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. Again, he sent out, verse 4, other servants, saying, "Tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are killed, and all things are ready. Come to the wedding." But they made light of it and went their ways, one to his own farm, another to his own business. God wanted these people to be a part of this great celebration. The rest seized their servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. But when the king, that's not King Herod, that's not King Caesar, that's King God. When the king heard about it, he was furious. And he sent out his armies, destroyed those murderers, and burned up the city. Who was responsible? What nation was responsible for destroying Jerusalem and burning up the city? That was Rome. Vespasian, who was at the time initially the Roman general who came down to take care of it, until the Roman emperor died, Vespasian was called back to Rome. Vespasian was then made the emperor. Vespasian sent his son Titus down to Jerusalem to finish up what he had started. But all the while in there, it's Rome who is coming up against Jerusalem. But who are these armies acting on behalf of, according to Matthew 22 and verse 7? They're acting on behalf of God. Jerusalem was destroyed. Was it destroyed in 70 AD for perhaps a different reason than it was destroyed in 586 BC? Why was Jerusalem destroyed in 586 BC? Why did God allow his nation to be taken away captive in 586 BC? What had they done? They were worshiping idols. They had turned against God. And so when God's own people are destroyed and taken captive in 586 BC, it is a result of the judgment of God for sin. When God talked about Nebuchadnezzar and talked about Babylon coming against Jerusalem, coming against Judah, God called Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. Did that mean that Nebuchadnezzar was bowing down before God and worshiping him and serving him? And does that mean that Nebuchadnezzar was faithful unto God until the day? No. God was using him. to do his will. 650 years later, when God brought another nation against Jerusalem to destroy it, was it for a different reason than other than that these people were turning against God? That they had turned their back on God and were no longer interested in being faithful unto him, and God was bringing judgment upon them for their sin. Whose army was he using? Oh, he's using the Roman army. Did the Roman army know that they were being used? Did Vespasian, did Titus know in AD 70? Did Titus know that when he came and wiped out Jerusalem that he was being used as a tool of God? No. No more than sometimes we know whether we are being used as a tool of God. No more than Mordecai could say unto Esther whether she was being used as a tool of God. What did Mordecai say to Esther? Who knows? But that you have been brought to this point for such a time as this. God uses people in different ways to fulfill his tasks and his work on this earth. It's interesting to begin to see how all of that folds out. When Vespasian died, his son Titus began to reign in his place. And then when Titus was no longer on the throne, Domitian, who was one of the most wicked of all emperors, came to the throne. And he was one who really perfected, if you want to use that word, perfected and demanded even stronger that he be worshipped, that he be venerated by the people, and that he be held up as their God. If you lived in the Roman Empire during this period, how strong could your faith be? When you have a nation that kicks the Jews and Christians too out of Rome, as Claudius did, when you have emperors who are demanding that you worship them, how strong could your faith be? It's interesting to see how all of these emperors progress, to see how their evil and vile nature progressed and began to grow, and to see how all of this impacts the Christians. In Acts chapter 8 and verse 4, it says that the Christians, because of persecution, were scattered abroad. They had to leave Jerusalem because of persecution. They had to leave Judea because of persecution. But what did they do in Acts 8 and verse 4? Those who were scattered abroad went everywhere doing what? Preaching the word. There's going to come a point, maybe we're already there, it's going to come a point in the history of this nation where you're going to be able to lay the Roman Empire next to the American Empire and maybe not be able to tell the difference. Where you're going to see what happened in the rise and fall of the Roman Empire and to see it mimicked almost exactly in the rise and fall of the American Empire. Yes, sir. That's scary, isn't it? When Jerry talks about the power-hungry leaders of the Roman Empire and how they began to demand more and more and more for themselves, you know, the day may come where we get some power-hungry leaders in America. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a far-fetched idea, you think? Where they just demand more and more for themselves. Where will our faith be? I'm not here to talk politics. Where will our faith be? When because of persecution we are scattered, when we are dismissed from various places, or we're forced out of our jobs, or we're forced out of whatever circumstances we may be in because, well, you know, we're not tolerant unto the Christian faith anymore, what will you do? Will you go everywhere preaching the word? Will you be like Paul and use every opportunity that is presented unto you to preach the gospel? And not just use the opportunities presented unto you, but to create more opportunities to teach others the gospel. So here's a brief look at some of the Roman side of it in the Caesars. But now I want us to see how that overlaps and how that helps us to connect the Roman side of it with the Jewish side of it. Because while there is the great Roman Empire, the Roman Empire designated and set out certain kings to reign over certain parts of their empire. The first, the greatest one that we see that impacts our New Testament era is Herod the Great. What do we know about Herod the Great? What stands out about Herod the Great to you that you know of? Look at Matthew chapter 2. In Matthew chapter 2, again, sometimes we see the word Herod, and we think Herod was his name. When we read Pharaoh, when we read Caesar, when we read Herod, and there's other words like that, y'all can help me with them, I guess. While that is a name by which they are designated, that wasn't the name their mama gave them, in all likelihood. That was their position. And so when we read about Herod, we read about Herod the Great. We read about, and he's not called this, but he is, Herod Philip, Herod Antipas, Herod Agrippa. They're all Herods in a sense. So when you read in Matthew chapter 2, do I have that up here yet? When you read in Matthew chapter 2 about Herod slaughtering the infants, trying to kill baby Jesus. And then you read at the end of Jesus' life about when Jesus was on trial before Pilate, that Pilate sent him to Herod. Is that the same Herod? Is that the same guy? I mean, it's got the same name. I mean, is that the same Joe? Is it like calling this guy Joe that slaughtered the infants and it was Joe who tried Jesus? No, two different men. And so it's helpful for us to see, I think, how these all interrelate and to see that these are different individuals. Herod the Great was the one who was responsible for the slaughter of those infants. When Herod died, Herod bequeathed, I guess you could say, his territory to his sons. And so in the New Testament, we read about Archelaus. Archelaus was a son of Herod, and he ruled over Judea, which included Samaria and Idumea. And I think the first lesson this quarter, we looked at some geography things, and it would be helpful for you in your mind to be able to picture where Samaria and Judea and then Idumea, when you look down on your map, if you've got a Bible map and look just east of the Dead Sea, that's the region that Archelaus had. Now, at one time, Herod the Great was king over all of it. But Archelaus got that southern part of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. Antipas, you can call him Herod Antipas, he got a part of the northern region up in Galilee and Perea. And then Philip got even further north, north of Galilee. Herod had another son, Aristobulus. We don't read about him in the New Testament. He did not receive any land from his father, but he is important because he was the father of Herod Agrippa. We read about Agrippa. In fact, we read about two of them. We read about Agrippa in the book of Acts. And so that's where Aristobulus has a key part to play. So we only have about 2 minutes. Let me see if I can briefly go through this to help us. Herod the Great reigned until 4 B.C. When Herod died, three of his sons took over the major areas that he ruled. Archelaus took over that southern region. Archelaus is the one that we read about when Joseph and Mary, they heard that Herod had died. Remember, where did Joseph and Mary flee? They fled to Egypt. When Herod the Great died, they began to make their way back to Judah until they heard that Herod's son, Herod, was reigning in his place. Herod the Great's son, Archelaus, was reigning in his place. They knew how corrupt and vicious this man was. And so instead they went into the region of Nazareth up in Galilee. And so we read about Herod the Great in Matthew 2 in the beginning of the chapter. We read about his son Archelaus in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 22. Then we read about Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was the one who married Herodias. And John the Baptist came and told them, it is not lawful for you to have her. Now, when we read this, we're reading about John the Baptist saying this to Herod. It's not Herod the Great. He's already dead. He tried killing Jesus. It's not Herod Archelaus, who Joseph and Mary were afraid of. That's the brother in the south. Is that the second bell? You're going to kill me right here in the middle of these brothers. All right. We're going to have to, not next week, because we have the lectureship. Not the week after that, because we have a mission report. 3 weeks from today, yikes. For 3 weeks, you need to remember everything we've just said about Herod. All right, just take a second, lock it in. All right, here's the point for today. All right, we've had to stop in the middle. Here's the point for today. When you begin looking at how all of these governments and political systems interrelate, there are two things to see. One, Galatians 4 verse 4 says that Jesus was born at the exact time God wanted him to be born. God was working all of this out for the good of Christianity. And number two, to see that even in the midst of all of this violence and hatred toward Christianity, Christianity still thrived. And it didn't die. Take those 2 points, think about them, remember this for 3 weeks, we'll pick up again. All right.